Thank you very much, Minsky. You're still my dear friend. My teachers, colleagues, fellow students, ladies and gentlemen. I have dealt with the subject, facets of it, in several papers. I do not want to repeat that which you can read, the latest entitled The Ethics of the Halacha and Jewish Living, which was published in Cleveland most recently. I propose to deal with what I think are the practical aspects of the problem, to define what is the problem of the ethics of the Halacha and Haggadah for the contemporary Jew, and to suggest perhaps a method of dealing with the problem. The subject assigned to me, the ethics of the Halacha and Haggadah in the life of the contemporary Jew, has, without resorting to hyperbole, considerable latitude. In order to bring the topic within manageable dimensions and to facilitate communication, I hope, I shall begin with some definitions and assertions which to me at least appear reasonable and even self-evident. In any case, there are a number of assumptions implicit in my analysis. These I would make explicit. I should first focus on the word Jew in the subject, the contemporary Jew. The word Jew has meaning. To say that one is a Jew, forgive me for saying the obvious, but sometimes it helps. To say that one is a Jew identifies on many levels. It is not an all-encompassing, nebulous, non-referential term. The legitimate meaning of the word excludes and includes. It refers to something concrete and real. I am a Jew, or the identity he is a Jew, is a statement of significant content. Even on the unconscious, non-volitional, passive level, even if the word Jew is only a designation attributed by others, or if it refers only to the accident of birth, I was born a Jew, that is all. Even on this level, the identity Jew speaks significantly. The person so identified makes assertions by his very being and existence. He himself may not be aware of the contents of his mute utterance, but others hear it and are affected by it. And so is he, more than he knows or is ready to admit. He then is a witness. He gives testimony. More subtly, perhaps, even on the passive, unaware, or dimly aware, minimal level, the designation Jew affects attitudes, values. On the deepest psychological level, really, one's view of oneself and of the world about him, by being identified as a member of a historic community, a minority variant, he becomes voluntarily or passively the bearer of the cluster of myths associated in the Western world with the image of Jew. And he thus inevitably experiences something of that history, regardless of whether he chooses to affirm or to deny that syndrome of historic experience. It may be useful to probe the subtleties of Jewishness on this level, and to some extent it has been done, but that is not our task this morning. The word Jew, the designation Jew, becomes more significant, affective, and creative as the individual brings his identity conscious awareness. As he chooses, when one's Jewishness becomes a matter of will, volition, and conscious commitment, there are, to be sure, other options. Whereas the rabbis of the Talmud envisioned the possibility for the rejection of one's status as a Jew only with reference to a minor who was converted by the authority of the court, kishehigilu yicholim limchot, when they reach majority, they may reject. That option is at least theoretically available to everyone in a free open society. A Jew may choose to reject his identity, He may give preference to the on the conscious, mature level to the universal human experience. He may even hear it as a divine imperative at this juncture in history. Whether such an option is real, whether it can be successful within our sociologic context, these are questions beyond the ken of our discussion. I do believe, however, that even the conscious, aware Jew cannot rest in a self-righteous smuggling. Compelling serious alternatives challenge. They challenge him almost daily. They give him no rest and compel him to bring his most fundamental choices, his very being as a Jew, into radical question. But that again is quite another subject. I would only make explicit. This not to be smug, not to be, that we cannot be so certain. Sometimes these glib answers and glib syllogisms frighten me. And it is that I would emphasize. I would only make explicit that the Jew in my subject, the Jew about whom and to whom I'm speaking, is the conscious volitional Jew. The Jew who has chosen his Jewishness and has committed himself to it. Can we assume such an audience in a rabbinical seminary among a group of Reform rabbis? Well, and can we go on from there? This is, it requires a totally different paper if I can assume that Jew. I honestly and quite candidly don't know. My experience as a teacher of rabbinic students, of rabbis, and even some of the questions and comments at this colloquium make me wonder, at times, whether it is not that prior choice, our choosing to be Jews, whether that is not the real, though hidden, agenda of our every discussion. There are times when I feel that our rabbinic students spend their years in fighting instead of deepening the very commitment which their presence in our seminary implies. I say this not lightly. Be that as it may, I'm convinced that a serious probing of the ethics of the halacha and haggadah on a level other than pedantic curiosity or shallow and largely dishonest apologetics or polemics, on the level of involved concerns, relevance, and even objectivity can be undertaken only after the choice has been made. After we have chosen, when we have affirmed that we shall find depth, fulfillment, meaning, guidance within the experience of this historic community, then we may search and struggle and create with the assurance of Yagata Matata, seek and you shall find. It is only within the context of such a choice that we need not fear to look at a traditional text straight, to let it speak for itself without apology, fearful that it may not quite measure up or serve on its most obvious level as an apologetic proof text. Nor will we be prompted, if we choose, to ask the question constantly, what is Jewish in all of this? Or what is your authority? The committed Jew speaks with the authority of one who belongs. His utterance is Torah. He does not require a proof text. Think about this. That is the meaning of Rav's statement, what fools these mortals be. They rise for a scroll of the law, a dead piece of parchment, but not for a great man, a great teacher. He is the real Torah. Only Gvilim Sorfim. You can burn the parchment, but not the Torah. That is the Talmudic procedure of citing a ma'aser, the conduct of a sage, as a source for halacha, for halacha, or even an act in the presence of a sage to which he did not object, That is the source for halakha. And interestingly, as a footnote, we do say that we use this as the source of halakha only if it is not the stringent point of view, if he is not the machmir, if he is the mekil. If he is the machmir, we don't use it, because we say, she'efshar she'hem machmirim al atzmam, perhaps they make it stringent for themselves. But at any rate, if we are inside, a totally different spirit prevails. That is also the intent, I believe, of the Talmudic statement, Kocha dahetera adif. Only the confidence of real commitment frees one from the crutch of a literal precedent or a proof text, and allows one to disregard the text. I'm going perhaps a little beyond the Talmudic phrase now. To be permissive, surely. And so again, the Jew of which I speak is the Jew who has chosen, and by having done so, he has said minimally that the experience of the sacred community is of relevance. Its reach and its moorings, its hopes and dreams and struggles make a difference. It is all vital for me and my life. I need to know this saga. I shall engage the record of this experience in prayerful dialogue. I shall immerse myself in this tradition, written and oral, struggle with it, suffer and cry and laugh with it. And at some level, I appropriate the primitive, the absolute, the godly, embedded in its many layers of interpretation and application. The historic Jewish experience makes demands upon me, such a Jew sense, at a level. And as I encounter the significant options, I cry out from the depths of my commitment, I must, because I'm a Jew, I can do no other. So much for the word Jew. Now, ponder with me for a moment, the word contemporary in our subject, contemporary Jew. I choose to understand by this word contemporary more than a temporal or physical denotation. The contemporary Jew of my subject is not merely the Jew who is physically present in the 20th century. The world is full of pre-Ice Age mentality. Neanderthal man is a contemporary phenomenon, and he is often a bocce, an expert in proof text. Contemporary to me means one who is totally present, aware. He is nuclear age man, post-Darwin and post-Marx and post-Freud. He's open and receptive, stimulated and alive. He thinks in categories of a time-space continuum. I don't say that these are words and they're show-off words, and please forgive them. But I want to draw a picture of the kind of human being that many of our students and rabbis are. And it is to them, to this committed, aware Jew that I would speak. The content of his messianism is not restricted to the reach of Talmudic man or even a Maimonides. He is stimulated by the radical breakthrough in genetics and technology. He is aware of the reach of even of a Buckminster Fuller or a Norman Brown, and may even be affected by the pool of a McLuhan. He sees the possibilities of the Jew within the realities of an open society, not a nostalgic anchoring for medieval ghettos. He ponders seriously the movements and groupings and aesthetics, the visual arts, music. There's a vast, exciting world that's taking place in all of these areas, and the man is present. And may I say, perhaps, that this man, this contemporary man, sees not only decay and demoralization, but also messianic possibility in this greater complexification which confronts us, in the restless search of our thinking young people science may be redemptive after all. That is, I'm worried sometimes about the metaphysical syllogism, which reduces the scientific metaphysics and results only in reification and manipulation. There is another side as well. And some may not like it, there is a Chardin in it, messianism that comes out of it too, and even a Huxley. And some of the messianisms projected out of a combination of Freud and Marx are highly imaginative and may have religious impulse at the core. At any rate, he is open. He's open to the fact that ethics is not the monopoly. He shies away from these statements. You know, finitism cannot result in a mission. They're oversimplifications. In atheistic societies, people are very ethical, and studies show that being theistic, in quotation marks, does not necessarily mean a greater ethical, and that people in churches are bigots, and in synagogues. And so, then there's a tentativeness. Now, this contemporary Jew, this Jew who knows that his mind, his attitude, his emotional responses are shaped, influenced by total Western tradition, and then in America by an Anglo-Saxon heritage, as well as by his Jewish background, this man confronts the ethics of the Halakha and the Haggadah to deepen and to find guidance. Not as a neutral observer, not as an outsider, but from within, with love and devotion and profound reverence. And what are the problems he encounters? Before applying to this question, let us consider just for a moment the phrase, the ethics of the Halakha and Haggadah. Ethics of may imply that we are considering a tangential element, something which may be extrinsic or not very significant, not at the heart of the matter. Now, we surely know, and perhaps it is superfluous and needn't be said, for surely we must know that ethics is constitutive of Halakha and Haggadah. The ethical imperatives are the heart and soul of Torah. Halakha is the application, the concretization of the ethical demand. There cannot be separation of religion and ethics in Judaism. The primary religious experience, as Dr. Atlas pointed out yesterday, is ethical. Adonai Echad is an ethical experience. Liachit Shemo, Letakin Olam, Adonai Eloheinu, Ba'olam Hazeh, Adonai Echad, Ba'olam Haba. It is messianic. It has an imperative in it. Vahavta. It is every summation of Judaism in rabbinic literature. Everyone, whether it is Psalm 15 to the verse from Micah, what does the Lord your God require of thee? You know all this. Or Hillel's summation, or Akiva's love thy neighbor, or Ben Azai's, this is the book of the generations of man in the image of God created him. They are all ethical. That the summations of the rabbi are all ethical. You know all the statements from Abba Shaul's Ze'ili Ba'anvil, have a domelo, be like unto him, Ma'afanum Rahum, Ma'afatafanum Rahum. So on, lo barach HaKadosh Baruch Hu et ulama alamo ela b'cheted uberachamim. Acheri Adonai telehu v'cheyafshar yelehu v'cheyafshar l'adam lelech achar HaKadosh Baruch Hu v'lo kvar ne'emar ki esh achlai ela acheri derachav shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And so on, just as God clothes the naked and visits the sick, so you clothe the naked and visit the sick. The commandments were given to Israel only to refine them, to purify them. Perhaps a little free translation. The entire Torah needs of loving kindness. As I just recall, how central all this is. These are not isolated statements. They occur and recur. The creation, the very experience of creation is blessing. Barasa, bet, bereshi. And so, down the line, the bereshit bara va'ahakach Elohim. First he creates and only then does he become God. God through creation is a significant statement. And the beautiful interpretation, your humility makes me great. God at the very first humbles himself in order to exalt man. As they read, Anvat Fatya Tarbeni, your humility. And it's so beautifully expounded these drashim from the beginning of Genesis by Dr. Smolensky. Kol ha-Torah kula mipnei darkei shalom habayat, as you know, this statement. And darkei darkei noach ikod v'chol netivotehem shalom. And so God identifies himself as the Redeemer and the very first commandment, Yetziat Mitzrayim. And there are the infinite subtleties of the Midrash and the Halakha too, and they all speak the same message. It is at the heart, inseparable, at the core. The experience of the Jew, the religious of the experience of the Jew, cannot be separated from the ethical. The ethical is at the heart of it. And not only the rational social commandments, but the ritual are all placed within this general ethical framework, on and on endlessly. Every handbook on Jewish ethic lists them, and there are a number. Now, I'm not now evaluating the substance of the ethics of the Halakha and Agada, but that the ethical imperative is a demand of the framework and the central pillar of rabbinic Judaism, the Judaism that has lived. The Judaism we know, as Professor Alinsky so well put it, is indispensable. The ethical and religious are inexorably intertwined. They're inseparable. Perhaps this example may be familiar to you, which is meaningful somehow or other. It catches the spirit. You know, the rabbis confront the phrase, Lo achalil b'riti, God was not, says, I will not change my covenant. I will not change that which comes forth from my lips. And so they confront the Akedah story, and they say, God said, your seed will be established to Isaac. And then he said, take your one and only son. So how can God contradict himself, though? So if it is the Yitzchaki Karela Hazera, how can he say Kasna? It's the interpretation is forced, even for a Midrash, but it catches the rabbinic spirit. For the rabbis say, Mashal Mahadavad Romeh, what is it compared to a king who said to his best friend, bring me a boy to the table. And his best friend runs out and gets the boy and puts him on the table and takes a knife and is about to kill him. And the king said, are you mad? I said, bring the boy to the table, I can tell you to kill him. And so they go on to expound. God didn't say, kill Isaac. Abraham heard it. God couldn't have said it. He's bound by a prior covenant. How can God utter such a monstrosity? How can God ask to kill? I never told Jephthah to kill his daughter. I couldn't have. I spoke to Jephthah, yes, but I gave him commandments, but I never told him to kill. And Mesha, the king of Moab, now there's an interesting parallel here between the Midrash and the hero exposition in Kierkegaard, here in Termley. But at any rate, and so, and Mesha, I never even spoke to, so how can I tell you? God himself bound by the ethical commandments. Now, so we are ready to pose the problem. The contemporary Jew is troubled by war in Vietnam. He would turn to the Torah, to the embodiment and concretization of the ethical ideal. The sensitive Jew is concerned with issues of freedom of conscience, the right to dissent, with issues, social problems, the separation of church and state, the Negro, peace and war, with his tradition, his primary commitment as a Jew be of help, can it point the way toward it? Excuse me, I'm going to go. Beyond this, he's also confronted, and particularly the rabbi, that some of the rituals, yes, even the ethical rituals, the Sabbath, supposedly at the center are disregarded. My reply to the question, can this tradition point the way for him? My reply, hesitant, tentative, b'chilu radar, the fear and trembling. Yes, if we are really Jews, if our purpose is lahadib Torah, lahadira, if we are not looking for convenience and simple, facile answers, if we are prepared to struggle and wrestle, if we are ready to transcend and institutional bias and vested interests? Yes. My God, yes. If this Judaism to which we are giving our lives means anything to us. Dear people, know that I'm not talking about games or quoting rabbinic statements or finding proof texts for social action. Believe me, I can quote them by the thousands. That is all I do 7 days a week. I quote and I interpret, and I'm pretty good at it too. But my purpose is not to overwhelm with erudition, but to share a concern which is at the very heart of my life. I believe it is at the heart of our very lives. For unless we can answer yes with honesty, in a large sense, we're wasting our time. And I'm a rabbi. I can't see myself merely in the role of an academician. And this question means very much to me, and its answer as well. Certainly the answer is not in the literal. Professor Kravitz illustrated yesterday, Lou Siegel, urgent message. Professor Kravitz illustrated yesterday what the literal will offer with reference to three problems. I noticed that a number of colleagues in struggling with the problem of defense of Vietnam, referred to Maimonides and the Milchemet Mitzvah and Milchemet Rishut. I read it in a number of bulletins. We even had some sermons in the college chapel utilizing this as some sort of basis on which to constitute our attitude. It is instructive to look at the entire passage. Let's look at it for a moment. I'll translate freely. I have it here, just copied from the Mishneh Torah. A king must not make war at first, except a war of commandment, a milchemet mitzvah, a commanded war. And which is a milchemet mitzvah, which is a commanded war? It is the war against the seven nations and the war against Amalek, and to help the Jews from the hands of an enemy who comes upon them. And afterwards, he may fight a permissive war. And this is the war which he fights with other nations in order to enlarge the boundaries of Israel. God, is this going to be my God? It is a positive commandment to utterly wipe out the seven nations and everything that comes into his hand, everyone. And he does not kill him. He transgresses a negative commandment. By the way, this is based on biblical law, too. For it says, thou shalt not permit any soul to remain alive. It's painful to read it. You know, I'm sharing an experience with you because whenever I have to prepare such a paper, I go to the text and I read the codes and I read the sources, and I'm torn to pieces, literally. Now, is this going to be my basis, my guidance? Yes, he does go on to say, we do not make war with any man in the world until we call out peace, whether it is a permissive war or a commanded war. But then this goes on, that if they surrender, then we do not kill them. This is in a Milchemet Mitzvah, but we make them slaves, and so on. And he describes what kind of slaves they are, and but if they do not accept either the tax that's placed upon them or slavery, you kill them, and so on. Now, what kind of monstrosity is not to stand up and shout that this cannot be the Word of God in 1967? And anyone who would maintain that this represents finality or ultimacy, is he preaching Judaism? Here's where we would go, and I see these boys running around with Milchemet Mitzvah, Milchemet Rishut. And this is the way I'm going to determine my attitude to Vietnam, where every fiber of my being knows that it's throwing Nha Plam on kids is monstrous. And this is what this is to be my guidance. Attitude towards the non-Jew. I'm not going to read all of it. Why should you share my own pain that I went through? Just this, we were looking for guidance on dissent. And so I just went, perhaps I didn't go to the right place, I didn't spend very much time on it. I went to the section on Hilchot Mamrim. It suggested of the rebel, the dissenter. And we're speaking now not about just a plain, simple dissenter. We don't pay much attention to it. But if he's really a Zakid Mahmoudi, going to say he's an expert, he's a recognized authority, he has all the facts at his command. Now what happened? One who differed with the great base dean concerning a matter for which one is culpable for doing it intentionally to be cut off and unintentionally an offering, a sin offering, even if he says, I have received it from tradition, and afterwards I received it from my teachers. Since the matter was discussed and decided, this man is culpable. What does that mean? Such a man, the Torah decrees that he be put to death. And even if it's a matter of permitting chametz before the sixth hour on Erev Pesach. The list can be multiplied indefinitely. To read much of the halacha is a painful, even shattering experience. But then one turns to the contemporary practitioners. The so-called modern exponents of Torah Judaism. When one looks at the rabbinate in Israel, and one notices the use of coercive power to impose its view in the worst possible way. Have you followed the Nituach Beitim controversy in Israel? The embalming procedure, a little minutiae, and what a tremendous issue was made of it in order to gain power? You have all the evils of secularism, of secular power and religion. But even the fine, young, bright, modern Orthodox rabbis, the thinking ones, who somehow are in a dilemma. And they'll say, well, of course, you know, much of this is no longer in effect. After all, there is no Beit Din, etc. So, but nevertheless, why do we study it? Why do we study about the fine intricacies of how you stone a man? Now, this is quite an interesting procedure. Or how you burn him. This is also in the code, in the Mishnah, code, so on. Why do you do it? You do it, study and receive reward as a kind of exalted ethical lesson. Now, we don't practice anymore, but it's still an exalted ethical lesson. So we no longer practice the Hilchot Soreru Moreh, the rebellious kind. And the Talmud says, perhaps, Lo Hayah, the Lo Atid Liyot, but nevertheless study it. You know, have you studied Hilchot Soreru Moreh? It is studied for edification. Imagine teaching the intricacies. That would constitute the curriculum for our day schools. What else are we going to teach for all day? Or look at the laws vis-a-vis the non-Jew, or the Buddhist, or the Hindu. Are they Akum or Buddhist? There are idols all over the place. You know what you're supposed to do with the Akum? All right, so we say that the Christian is not quite the idol worshiper. But what are we going to do with the Buddhist? Coming one world. No, cannot be on a literal level. I've stated the case strongly because it needs it, as Rabbi Kravitz felt it needed it. Because this is our tragedy, our alliance is vanity, this literalism, this idolatry. It cannot be the literal level. And after all, why should we make a rigid fundamentalism out of the codes of the past? When the rabbis themselves, the whole rabbinic effort is to deny this with reference to the Bible. You see, what we've done is we've made a Torah shebichtav out of the codes. We have invested it with finality. We've made an idol out of it. Or this is the process, this is the literal process. It denies the heart of Judaism. It is a form of idolatry. Because Avodah Zarah Kulah Keneged Kol HaMitzvot, the Mechilta says, and the other places as well. And to make literal, to make final the time place, to make the human divine is the essence of idolatry, bibliolatry. And the only thing is we are afraid to call it by its proper name. We go to the literal. The rabbis in the Talmud were confronted have a beautiful law. It's a beautiful ethical law, really. It's the law of Bar Mitzvah. In terms of if someone has property contiguous to another piece of property, and the owner of the second piece of property sells his property, the neighbor has a prior right, the right of property. He doesn't even need a kinyan. It's automatically transferred. His right. And this is a beautiful concept so that his land will not be splintered and split up, so that the neighbor has the prior right. Now, it's interesting.
Oh, why, I'll take you up on it. I gave you money for it. What? I gave you money for one company. I still have a
post. They do not. What do? They go to the general ethical principle. Sur mira va'aseto. Depart from evil and do good. This is good. It's reasonable. It's halacha. It's Jewish. That's the word. You don't go to the details of literalism. And after all, why should... Well, I have a section here on the development of halacha in rabbinic times, but I'm going to skip it. Let me just say this. The statement is repeated again and again in the Mishnah, Dibru Chachamim Ba'uveh. The rabbis speak in the present. Halacha.
Well, come on, Mark. You're handling everything.
What are you giving me messianic law for? It's irrelevant. It operates within the situation. Halacha is essentially bohuma. And so we must look at the present, at the situation, as it is, to discern what the tendency, the melioristic tendency of the halacha really is. Within a society of slaves, law operates with slaves. And then if you look at it this way, you see a totally different aspect to the very same code of Maimonides occurring. You see the Talmud itself. Kone eved ivri, one who acquires a slave, a Hebrew slave, ke kone adon la'atzmo. It is as if he acquires a master. Because The privileges are so many. And you read the list, you see that it's almost impossible. And even the laws of Eretz Kanani are amazing and surprisingly humane within the historic context. But if I take the time, place, and make it eternal, if I take the situation and make that the halakha, I'm making idols. This is, you see, the in a society of slaves, the law be lyrics. In a society of war, the law be lyrics. Even for war, don't go out unless you want to make peace. A number of other statements which ameliorate, but within context. And a beautiful ethical tendency emerges if you look at the literature from this perspective. See, the problem is our temerity. We say we lack authority for halakha. What utter nonsense. We stand on the ground, the highest ground of Judaism. If we are serious, if we really believe in ourselves, if we're not playing games, if we're not interested just in what is convenient and comfortable, perhaps it can be formulated, make halacha haggadah, and haggadah halacha. That may be the process. There are permanent strands inherent in the tendency. These are dialectical. It's not so easy to find, to place a particular halacha in a situation and see it in context of what the total situation was. This is why objectivity is necessary in studying the text. For it is thus that we find tendencies to be more than our past, to reach for the future. Now, think of the Talmud expresses this tension, and I think perhaps it catches it. On the one hand, it speaks of the principle, et la sot la donai, heferu toratecha. It is time to work for God, destroy the Torah. In other words, don't be literal, it's time to work for God. On the other hand, they say, "Oti azru," on the phrase, "Ve'et torati shamaru," they have forsaken me. The rabbis interpret, "Would that they would forsake me and keep my commandments." Now here you have the tension, you see. God, the Kol, and Torah, they are in tension. And the two statements somehow seem to catch it for me and express it. Again, I repeat, our difficulty is that we're timorous. We question our authority, we have no comfort, and many of us don't have the knowledge. Let's face it. Because to operate in reform halakha this way, you need to know more than the literal. One has to deepen himself more than the literal. Now, Rabbi Ruiz mentioned yesterday that we still have an eye half cocked on the Shulchan Aruch and what's the Orthodox going to say. And many of us wouldn't be right. I know it's true with me when I look inside. Somehow or other, we carry with us an image. You know, that our image of the real Jew Rabbi Yehudah Teitelbaum. My dear people, this is a tragedy. And I speak to myself as well, for what is at stake here is our total future, for surely on this level, no intelligent person is going to pay any attention to what we say, nor will they take it seriously. Look at the tendencies, and you find them. The sanctification of life, l'chaimayim. How largely rich is this? Pikuach nefesh doche, everything. the danger to life. Freedom. Yes, even within slaves. And so on, down the line. I mean, the whole range of the literature is there. Now, so one way is to find the tendency. Then, with due apologies to Joe Fletcher, I will use the word situation. A balancing of values. Sometimes there is a conflict of values. And so we are called upon to make choices. And rabbinic Judaism always made the ethical choice when there was a conflict of values. You know, even Hillel's proposal was explained that Hillel violated a law to serve a higher law because he saw the people refuse to let him. So he made the prosopol. He abandoned to serve an ethical principle. You can tell a lie. To tell a bride she's beautiful. Kalana ava hasida ilel beso anyway. You're making a choice for an ethical principle. You wait. God told a lie to keep peace between Sarah and Abraham. And the whole list of examples in that passage. What an overwhelming and beautiful prospect this Jewish tradition represents. Well, balancing of that, but in terms of today, in terms of the realities of today. And I'll mention Professor Kohan, who is a pious Jew and a teacher of mine, told me the very first day I entered the Hebrew Union College. I didn't quite grasp the meaning, but it's a true statement, I think. To be a real Reformed Jew, it is then that you need Yirat Shamayim. However you understand the word. For this is the way one operates. Well, now, another factor in the process of making halakha, you know, there is the rabbinic principle in mashgichin bevatku. We do not pay attention to the divine voice. And you remember the famous passage in Bava Metzia that's so often quoted. We quote it with such pleasure. How Rabbi Yehoshua wouldn't pay attention to jumping trees and to falling walls. And he said, the Torah has already said, Aharei Rabim Lahatot, follow the majority opinion, Torah lav bashamayimi, the Torah is not in heaven. And then Elijah reports that the good Lord was sitting up in heaven and laughing away, and he says, boy, my boys have done well. Nitzchuni banai. Well, it's a beautiful passage. We all love it. But I wonder whether we don't quite look at this passage, or it might not bear a second look. Maybe we should pay attention to jump, to falling. To trees being chopped down. Maybe we should pay attention to the voice that calls. That perhaps Ahari Rabin Lahatot in that instance, or within the mood of developing Judaism, is a very conservative, a very reactionary, a fundamentalist principle. That perhaps the dynamic principle is the Batkol. And perhaps that is one of the problems in Halakha with the constant qualification that when we said Chacham Adif Min Avi and so on, that we have taken away the living, the juice out of this tradition. And so we say, yes, the voice confronts. I'm not theologizing, I'm not a theologian. And I don't, the definition that we use are secondary. They are not part of the primary experience. We hear a pull and we hear a demand, and our conscience plays and leaves no rest. That's the primary experience. The secondary explanations, I don't think, are that important. Now, perhaps we should listen to that, but we would be in a better position. So we'd be a little before it was decided and then they finally said he must be. Perhaps it's time. And messianism, which is a tremendous tide which pulls forwards and is at the heart of much of the Haggadah. And let me say again that I think in Judaism you never had a utopianism. It's always been messianism, because when you're operating with the thought that God can do anything, it's never utopian. See, utopianism only becomes utopianism once you bring God down to human science. So that Judaism always operated. Yes, in Judaism you had messianism and apocalypse, but never utopianism. And there's much in that, but I won't probe it. Well, and then just this one final thought. The very pain, you see, if I really feel the rooting, the mooring, if I really made the choice, and then I read the text, and it hurts me, even if I understand the context, sometimes I read it, even if I understand the tendency, it hurts me. And I must reject even that, sometimes. That wrenching experience, dear people, is a high ethical experience, let me tell you. You feel something so deeply that only a Jew who's gone through it knows it. You know, perhaps it doesn't quite illustrate it, but think of there is a response of the Ramor, Moses Sicilis, where he once married an orphan girl Friday evening on the Shabbat. He was bitterly attacked. You know, you can only appreciate the preciousness of Achnasat Kalah, of how dear a human being is in our tradition, when you place yourself into the situation of Aramor, and nobody did. What kind of wrench this must have been? Now, here are the subtleties. I have sort of changed my mind. I've always opposed a guide for Reform Judaism. But I'm frightened what's happening to us. And I think that not written on the level of public relations or usual shallowness or almost usual, that we of Reform Judaism have to call a small conference with an agenda of concerned rabbis and scholars, not a large one, 35 people, and not restricted to Reformed rabbis, but include conservative rabbis who are within the general framework of this looking for the tendency, who see the horizontal influences in the development of the halakha. And let us really, with dedication, make of this our life a tree of life to hold on to.
Following the ethical procedure that we have set up for this colloquy.
The hasten of the birth pangs of the Messiah. Okay, so you're making the... Right, the pleasures and vices, but it was the rabbis and their failure to militantly fight against the position of the church and of the nobility, which permitted the ghetto community to develop and to last for as long a period as it did. So if you turn around and speak to the entire group, I think it would be easier. Now seriously, it's hard for them to hear, and they should. Okay, let me just repeat your indictment that had the rabbi not been a coward during this medieval period and fought for his people like Rabbi Hatzah Hillel Silver did in recent years, the ghetto world would never have come into being. And I agree with you 100%. Had the rabbi stood up and fought like a hero, we would have no glimpse into the ghetto to worry about. We'd have nothing to worry about. We wouldn't be here. Now, let me just add one more idea. No. You know, I think we ought to get out of the notion that the church we see today is like the church we saw centuries ago. It isn't. That the Protestant church we see today is like the Protestant church of the 16th and 17th century. It wasn't. Or that the rights of speech that we have today existed then. They didn't. Kings ruled by divine right. It was believed even by the most liberal spirits of that day that if you be a good king, you crush your opposition. You don't let contamination into your society. If they stand up, cut them down. Why listen if you don't have to? There was no need to listen to minority opinions during the 16th or 17th century, unless that minority opinion was sufficiently strong to cause you to listen. And the only way that you got to be strong enough to be listened to sufficiently to be given a residence permit was to prove his value to the Lord. If he stood up any other way, he would have disappeared.
This morning, let us examine a slice of Jewish history, a cross-section of the life of the Jewish people in the 20th century, this past year, 1964. Jewish history is not parochial. It's not limited by definite and defined boundaries. It's not contained within a unit of land or of culture. Jewish history is always world history. The Jewish people ever since the diaspora have been scattered, dispersed throughout the globe. To understand their history, we must always understand the setting and the geographical background within which they lived. Where were the Jews at the beginning of this year, 1964? There were 13,121,000 Jews on this globe at the beginning of this past year. 75% of them lived in three areas of our world. There were 2,121,000 Jews in the land of Israel, 2,740,000 Jews within the communist bloc countries, and 5,600,000 Jews
in this land of the United States. Together, these three communities comprise three quarters of the population of the Jews. These three communities, products of the accidents of the past, hold within them the destiny of our Jewish people. What happened to them during the past year, their setbacks, their achievements, their challenge, this was Jewish history of 1964. The most painful fact in Jewish life in this past year is the wall. Not of brick and stone, but as impenetrable. The wall which is being erected within the countries of the communist bloc, especially in the land of Russia. A wall which is separating the Russian Jew from his religion and from his co-religionists throughout the world. The communist world is frightened by people who have allegiances other than to the atheistic, materialistic state. The Russian Jew has frightened the communist. He fears his allegiance to a faith which has a God. He fears his ties of kinship to his co-religionists throughout the world. Now, this fear of other loyalties is not something limited to the communist fear of the Jew. It applies to all minorities within the Russian world. But somehow the Jew has felt the impact of this concern much more than any other group within the Soviet Union. When the Jew goes to pray, it is no longer an act of faith. It's become an act of defiance. For he makes himself vulnerable to retaliation. If a Jew wishes to study, he finds facilities non-existent if he wishes to learn about his religion. There are no schools to train the young, and hardly a school to train rabbis. And Jewish synagogues have been undergoing a process of erosion during the past decade. We have it on good authority from official Russian publications that in the past 7 years, 396 synagogues within the Soviet Union have been destroyed, leaving less than 100 synagogues for the total population of the Jews. To understand what this means, let us remember the fact that in America, where we have 1 million Reform Jews, we have more than 700 synagogues. A Jewish population, such as the one that exists in Russia, by the same standards, would require 1,700 synagogues. Presently, less than 100 synagogues are in existence in Russia. Let me dramatize this for you a bit. A news report reached these shores on May 29th. It came from the community of Minsk, which just decades ago had a population of 600,000 Jews, more than all the Jews presently in Chicago. Presently, as a result of the Nazi experience, there are some 56,000 Jews in Minsk, about three-quarters the size of our Cleveland Jewish community. But only one synagogue remained, a centuries-old structure, dilapidated. The one remaining synagogue of the proud Jewish community of Minsk. The Jews of the city requested permission to build another synagogue, but permission was refused. On May 29th, while Jews were worshiping inside the synagogue, workmen came and the process of its demolition was begun. Now we can say that religious discrimination is not something unusual in the Soviet Union. Russia regards itself as an atheistic land and it feels that religion is not in keeping with its premises. And we can conclude that these religious discriminations are purely part and parcel of the total philosophy of the land. And so we felt for a long time that the Jews weren't being singled out in their discrimination. Now we have begun to learn that this is not so. When we look into other areas of life, we find that a process has begun which singles out the Jew for discrimination. The economic trials which have been taking place for the past few years within Russia, 60% of those tried and executed were Jews. When we look at the figures of Jews in the professions and public life, we see that they are rapidly declining. Jews who once were overly represented among the students at the universities have fallen drastically in their proportions in the last few years. And perhaps the most crucial sign is the fact that recently books bearing the official seal of the government have started appearing in the Russian market, highly reminiscent of the anti-Jewish literature of the Nazi period. One of them, especially, Judaism Without Embellishment, has caught the fancy of the entire world. A review and a return to the attacks of the malicious lies of three decades ago. It has become obvious, especially to Jews throughout the world, that a campaign of cultural genocide is afoot in Russia, one which is aimed at the Jewish people, and its intent is obvious, to destroy the cultural integrity, the will to live of the Jewish community of Russia. And unhindered, this campaign, if it continues, is predestined to succeed. These facts have marshaled Jewish world opinion in the past year to acts of concern and obligation to their brethren in Russia. Perhaps the most important action which occurred was at an extraordinary conference of 24 national American Jewish organizations, which was held in Washington this past April. Virtually every American Jew was represented at this conference, which broadcast powerful and strong appeals before the bar of world opinion, highlighting the actions which were presently taking place within the Soviet Union. And this conference had tremendous impact throughout the world. Within a matter of weeks and months, hundreds of Jewish communities and Jewish organizations paralleled these conferences and added their words and their strength to its concern. And this concern was not limited to the Jewish world, but the non-Jewish world rose up in response. Non-Jews from all sectors of life, ministers, politicians, jurists, mayors, governors, and not limited to America alone, but throughout the world, spoke in defense of the Russian Jews. And these non-Jewish voices included powerful statements by the influential International Commission of Jurists, and also a resolution passed on the Senate floor, U.S. Senate Resolution Number 204. Perhaps the most unexpected voices to be raised were those which rose up from within the communist world itself. The communist parties of Italy, of France, Scandinavia, of America, of Canada, of Australia, and elsewhere all pointed the finger of accusation at Russia, condemning its policy of cultural genocide aimed specifically at the Jews. But what good did this all do? Internally, no changes occurred, neither under Khrushchev's leadership nor under that of his successor. The policy of genocide continued and still continues. Yet, to the outside world, Russia betrayed her sensitivity. The synagogue that was destroyed in Minsk, which created a worldwide reaction, is being rebuilt today in October after the criticism had been heard. The Russian government announced that the Jewish community of Minsk has been granted its request to build a new synagogue. Also, the book Judaism Without Embellishment, one of the many books attacking the Jews, but the one which received worldwide publicity. The Russian government disowned the book, saying that it was printed unofficially, as if anything is printed unofficially in the Soviet Union, and its authors were publicly chastised and punished. But anti-Semitic literature still is being written and officially sanctioned, and Jewish synagogues are still being razed and destroyed. But Russia is sensitive to world opinion. Within the Jewish community in Russia, very little is known, but the feeling among official visitors is that the Jewish community has been strengthened by the worldwide concern for its plight, and that attendance at its synagogues have increased during the past year. What the future holds in store, we cannot say. We can say that world Jewish opinion has been mobilized and must remain mobilized if any chance remains for the saving of Russian Jewry. From the darkness, let us turn to the light. Israel continues to grow and to develop and to flourish. By the middle of this year, its population grew to 2.5 million souls. It is still continuing its Herculean task of absorbing all strains of Jews and also Arabs and Christians into its evolving growth, and it is doing so effectively, intelligently, and with a minimum of racial bias and friction. Its rate of economic growth continues strong. In the past 5 years, it has averaged an annual rate of economic growth of 10% per year, which makes it one of the highest rates of growth in the world. David Bell, who is the director of the American Foreign Aid Program, in commenting on the state of Israel, indicated that Israel indicates what can be done by a nation with an unhappy balance of natural resources, by intelligence, by hard work, by sound policies, and by sensible implementation of technological and scientific knowledge. Israel has become the unparalleled example of what an undeveloped nation can achieve. And increasingly, the undeveloped nations of the world are turning to Israel for guidance and for leadership. Some important breakthroughs occurred in the life of Israel during this past year. One, a rather quiet event, which I predict will probably grow in importance during the coming years, was a trade agreement which was signed between Israel and the Euromark countries, the six countries of the European Common Market. This rather inostentatious trade agreement, which would permit Israel to have preferred treatment for some of her exports to the six countries of the Euromark, is taken by many Israelis as being the first step to a closer membership on the part of Israel with the European market, leading perhaps to full associate membership of Israel in the common market. I suspect we shall hear much more of this possibility in the future. An alliance of Israel with the common market, which has become perhaps the leading industrial and economic market in our world today, would be a tremendous step forward in the future growth of Israel. Another major step, and this more in actuality than in potentiality, concerns the problem of the water shortage, which has been plaguing the state of Israel. In 1955, President Eisenhower appointed Eric Johnston as a special ambassador to the Middle East. One of his major accomplishments was to carve out a water plan which would permit a number of countries above the Jordan River to divert the waters of the Jordan River for their mutual development. These countries, including Jordan, Lebanon, Syria, and Israel, all participated in the formulation of these plans, and all four countries approved the technical phases of the plans. In June 10th of this past year, Israel announced that it had implemented its portion of the plan and that it presently was successfully utilizing waters of the Jordan River for its own internal needs. This was done in complete knowledge and approval of our own U.S. government and in keeping with the technical plans which were approved by the four countries all bounding the Jordan Valley. Tied in with this was a desalination program whose purpose would be to sweeten salt water for consumption, which was announced by President Johnson. He announced a joint experimental program with Israel whose purpose would be to build a power plant in the state of Israel whose major purpose would be to desalinate salt water. It is expected that this plant will be in full operation by the year 1970. It is expected to produce 200 million watts of electricity, which will meet the power needs of the state of Israel in the year 1970, and it is also expected to produce 100 to 200 million gallons of sweet water daily, which will meet the water needs of the state of Israel in the year 1970. Taken together, these three steps amount to a tremendous economic move forward for our brethren in the land of Israel. The growth, the stability of Israel is assured, given her own perseverance, the continued intelligent help of countries who have come to her assistance in the past, and given the continued assistance of the American Jewish community, the future of Israel is assured if, however, the blind irrationality of the Arab world, led by Nasser, does not trigger an explosion in the Middle East which may start World War III. The Arab countries are embarrassed by the economic growth of Israel, and they utilize their most effective technique for hiding their embarrassment. They accuse Israel of being the cause of their distress. They point to Israel as the viper in the bosom of the Mideast, the unwanted guest who stood for more than dinner and who they are fearful will plan to drive them off of the Mideastern continent. Nasser, who is party to these irrational fears of the Arabs, also realizes that he can use them to his own advantage, recognizing that he alone has sufficient military force to counter the Israeli military machine. He tries to unify the Arab countries behind him so that one day, ultimately, he will succeed in achieving autonomy in the Middle East at the expense of driving Israel into the sea. This is an old story. It's not something new to the year 1964. What is new was the last of a series of events in this old story, which was climaxed in September of this year at a conference of 13 Arab kings and heads of states held in Alexandria, Egypt. The outspoken purpose of this conference was to formulate plans for warfare against Israel. The Arab states decided on two major conclusions and formulated plans for their implementation. One was on a strategy for the liberation of the land of Palestine from the Israelis, and two, the establishment of a united Arab force. They also decided how they would start this next war, which is to result in the destruction of the land of Israel. They would do so by inappropriately diverting waters from the Jordan River, which would prevent Israel from making use of its fair share of the waters. This would cause Israel to attack in self-defense, and this would be used as the cause for the war of liberation against the State of Israel. Though there is complete agreement on the part of the Arab countries on these broad general principles, fortunately, they still remain divided on the more elemental level of cooperation. Jordan, Syria, and Lebanon, though they agree totally with the plans of Nasser, have one limitation. They don't want Egyptian troops stationed in their countries. And since they lack adequate forces of their own, nothing can be done at this moment. Saudi Arabia and Egypt still keep alive their conflict over Yemen, and until that is resolved, the possibility of the liberation of Israel is still an element of the future. Yet this conference does highlight the central fear which the State of Israel has to live with. The fear that a moment of unity might come, and with it that moment of desperation. The situation of the Middle East is further complicated by the policies of our own State Department and by the policies of the Russian government. Our own State Department has been very firm and consistent in repeating in the most vaguest forms its conviction that it guarantees the borders of the State of Israel. It repeats these vague contentions time and time again, but all are puzzled by what they mean. If Israel is attacked, does this mean that the State Department promises that it will keep its lights burning all night for at least 1 week? Or does it mean that the United States government is prepared to defend with military force the integrity of the State of Israel? This question has been left vague, but America continues to repeat that it respects the integrity of the boundaries of the Middle East. Russia has been even vaguer, or more bombastic in his statements. When Khrushchev came to visit Nasser in Egypt some months ago, he stated unequivocally that the Egyptians can rely upon their Russian friends when needed. How Nasser is to interpret that statement, anyone can guess. During the past year, one resolve has been growing on the part of American Jews, and this is the conviction that there is one step necessary to ensure the stability of the Middle East. And if that step is not taken, the Middle East, and indeed the entire world, is in jeopardy. And that step is an agreement between America and the USSR guaranteeing in firm and unequivocal language the territorial borders which presently exist in the Middle East. If this is done, then Arabs and Jews can turn to their most important task, their own economic development, and in the process, we shall have diffused the most likely spot for the explosion which presently can lead to World War III. In the meantime, under this sword of Damocles, Israel prospers. The one land